Hola y bienvenidas al podcast. Welcome, welcome to Señora Power. This is Gabby.
This is Sophia.
This is Sonia.
You're listening to episode 3, part 2 of the Activist Señora series. If you haven't listened to part 1, where we chat about Alicia Escalante and her welfare activism in Los Angeles, then take a break and go check it out. There are so many ways to be a rabble-rouser and to make good trouble. Our señora for today shows us how to uplift without imposing, how to lead without being a leader, how to get things done without doing away with the community. Of course, we are talking about Maria Jimenez, labor organizer and señora. Much of the information of this episode comes from interviews our team conducted with people close to Señora Jimenez, as well as expert scholars who have written about her work and life. As always, the writing and interviews that we reference will be referenced in the show notes. We'd also like to thank the University of Houston Oral History Project, whose oral history of Maria Jimenez lends depth to our understanding of her. Now it's time to hear about señoras. Maria Jimenez, a pretty great activist, was born on August 2nd, 1950 in Coahuila, Mexico. Her family moved to Houston straight to Magnolia Park in 1957. And since that time, she began to learn about segregation through her everyday experience in a highly racist U.S. South. Jimenez recalls that when her family moved to Houston, the Magnolia Park neighborhood still felt majorly white. We know that this demographic changed quickly, especially as the white flight phenomenon began during this time and up to the 1960s. White families moved into newly built suburbs around the country as ethnic minority groups settled around the city center of major cities due to social network connections and cost of living. Maria's childhood in Houston attests to the change of demographics. She began her time at Franklin Elementary with many white classmates, then entering middle school with an increasingly Mexican community around her. She learned to survive among everyday discrimination that made up her surroundings. Children at her school were threatened with expulsion if they spoke Spanish. They could only play in Hidalgo Park, which was only called the Mexican Park. So get this, it actually did not have a name until the community itself named it Hidalgo Park in tribute to a historical figure of the Mexican independence, Father Miguel Hidalgo y Costilla. Now, for listeners who may not have been there, it's a really nice park with a gazebo where quinceañera pictures are taken, and a statue of Miguel Hidalgo y Costilla in the middle that the community funded to build. It's also a historically designated place that the community also fought to have this historical designation of this park. So the experiences of living this discrimination and also her family background, which I'll talk a little bit more about later, primed Jimenez for her later activism. Her first foray into organizing was at the Immaculate Heart of Mary Church. A priest there, Father Antonio Gonzalez, was gathering support for striking miners, and Maria got involved as a middle school student in the efforts, collecting food and money for these workers who were striking in the Rio Grande Valley, or the border between Texas and Monterrey, Mexico. Her high school days saw her bringing this drive for justice to the classroom as she centered her debate club experience around the budding civil rights movement. Before we get into her important college years, I wanted to ask you both, what stands out to you from Jimenez's childhood? What resonates with you and why? Debate club, striking minors, discrimination, an eclectic bag to choose from.
I actually wanted to start a little bit earlier because I think all of us know, and our listeners know as well, that moment of feeling othered or the moment of recognizing that some part of who you are is no longer in the majority or the dominant, like it sort of puts a spotlight on parts of you that are not accepted or actively looked down on. And so that can be a really defining moment for like a lot of people to have that othering part of your life as you move to a new place, especially like a new nation. And I also think that claiming of Hidalgo Park would have been fundamentally perspective changing, to be able to come together as a community and to have that be a space that they were probably already using all the time, and then to like have it recognized by the city is pretty incredible. And I can imagine that it showed her that you can get things moving, you can change things, you can claim things in a really powerful way, pretty early on.
Yeah, and kind of just building off of that, what I noticed about Maria's childhood and her, the beginning of her activism is how it's born. All of these like activist movements are born out of like a shared feeling of discomfort and like a shared feeling of discrimination towards oneself, right? So here, once again, we have like the space of the church and how that, functions as a space where people can get organized, when people can be vulnerable and share things, such as the discrimination that they're feeling, and then, to build community and do something about it, right? So yeah, I feel like this is why it's important to just rant with your friends every once in a while, because then that's how you start building collective power,
I think also I love that it's Immaculate Heart of Mary Church. We were able to do a very brief interview very early on in this podcast history and development. And it was a really surprisingly emotional sort of moment that we shared with an Immaculate Heart of Mary parishioner and administrator. And without going into any details, it was so clear how this church in particular had a history of really just being down for the community, just like really like generations of people just helping their community and making sure that they were supporting marginalized people and different vulnerable groups. So it's really great to see it come up again.
I think it's also worth noting that, Maria's story, especially at these early stages, is kind of a microcosm of a lot of Arceniana's stories, but also a lot of Mexican people's stories at the time in Houston. So, she encountered discrimination at school. Like, literally, you can't speak Spanish or you'll get expelled. Like, the teachers were reinforcing racism. And I think, that's one institution, right? And then you try to go to church, and luckily, I think Jimenez's family found community in church. But we know from our research and from interviewing people that it was actually an uphill battle as well. And Maria has said in other interviews that she remembers that her parents had been denied access to certain churches before they knew how things worked. That process of being denied access to a church is almost, unfortunately, universal at the early 20th century with Mexican populations in Houston that we've looked at. So I also want to return back to what you were saying, Sophia, about like ranting, because I think in a way it's really important, and you see it here with Jimenez, and you see it with some other señoras in different ways, but that when you can put into words what's happening to you is when your political consciousness starts in a lot of ways, and when you can get the ball rolling. For Jimenez, it was earlier rather than later, because as I'll mention in a bit, her family had a lot of kind of activist framework for her to base herself off of. Not everyone, I guess, is so lucky in that regard, and so that's, I think, also a huge difference that you see in Our Señora's histories, is when you're able to put into words, like, actually, this isn't right, or actually, the feeling that I had of being discriminated against is something that other people have too, and it's not right. So it's just also, yeah, it's interesting, and also that the fact that she was growing up and during a time which was the civil rights movement in the U.S. as well. But these are all great answers, and I want to continue on with Maria's story. So, that part of Maria's life was just the beginning, in my opinion. Her true señorahood began when she went to college. Jimenez's home situation was a little different, like I was saying, than some of our other señoras. Her parents were huge proponents of their daughters going to college. This was a really radical stance at the time, especially for parents of Mexican and Mexican-American girls. There was never any doubt that Jimenez would go to college. Her dad justified it to his peers and friends by saying that an education would help his daughters leave a possible bad marriage in the future, giving them independence. And this is already for the time also pretty radical to have this feeling of like, I want my daughter to be independent from a man. But Jimenez actually suspects that her father's motives were more radical than this, as she came from a family of labor organizers and, very outward Marxist. Her grandfather was a prominent unionist in Mexico before she was born. And there's this really great 2015 Houston History Magazine article written by Denise Gomez that we'll put some references to in the show notes. And that article states that Jimenez's mother and grandmother influenced her own idea of feminism even before Maria began to learn about the concept formally. Jimenez says that her grandmother always thought that women should be respected as hard workers, and her mother was a strong individual who found ways to organize even in the face of a strong-willed husband. So her grandmother used to say that, housework isn't romantic, it's like hard work. And that it should be treated like labor, because it was. And so I think that seeing this lineage of señoras who are very conscious of their value and their work's value, is pretty refreshing, and I think explains a lot about Maria's activism as well. She entered college, having been turned down for multiple scholarships on the basis of her Mexican heritage. So, not on the basis of her work, like she had really good grades and everything. She joined the debate club because she wanted to go into politics. And actually, a school counselor was like, "You will never make it in politics. So, you should not go into political science. You should try something like social science, which is more appropriate." But she, with the help of her dad was like, "No, you do what you want." So, she actually was able to go to college because her dad set money aside for that, and funded her college experience, because she couldn't get any scholarships because she was Mexican. She did know very early on that she wanted to pursue political science, and she joined the Young Democrats at the University of Houston early on. Because she said, this is the most leftist group that I can find, and they seem very plugged into political things. But she really grew disillusioned because of the racism she found there. She cites it being like Dixiecrats, which basically refers to a kind of quote unquote Democratic Party that was really concerned with keeping the racist status quo in the South specifically. And she found that there was a lot of kind of like concern for that, for keeping a status quo that kept Black people and Mexican people specifically down. So she moved from that organization to LOMAS, the League of Mexican American Students, and she looked for kinship and activism because she felt like, oh, this is Mexican Americans as well. Like, obviously, we'll work together to bring about change. At that time, Lomas was mostly a social group, which we know does not necessarily mean that it doesn't bring about change. However, it was not the change that Maria was looking for. And she herself, in her oral history, is very open about, they were doing work that they needed to make a community amongst each other, but that was not what she was looking for. Finally, Mayo was founded, so Mexican American Youth Organization, of which there were chapters around the country. This was actually like a pretty historic moment because it was part of like the youth efforts of the Chicano movement. And so she joined the chapter at University of Houston and met a lot of people who would be her associates even into her late adulthood. It made it possible for her to eventually run for and win the position of student body president at U of H. She was the first Latina student body president there, And it only came about because of the coalition work she did, even as an undergraduate. The way it worked basically was that she had become essential or a key figure in the background of all of these organizations I mentioned, and even with the Women's Rights Organization as well, which, as we know, at this time, especially in Houston, were led mostly by white women. So this meant that she was building coalition with people who mentally had material circumstances that were different from her own. But through these connections, it made it possible for her to be on a slate with other people from different ethnicity, identity groups, etc. A white undergraduate student, a white man, was supposed to be the president of this ballot. She was only supposed to be secretary or something else. But as the elections came forward, he became ineligible to run for office for one reason or another. And the agreement was that she would be president and then step down in favor of him once they had won. So she agreed to this, fully willing. People wanted her to lead, though. And when she got into the position, it ended up not working out, and she had to stay as president. So she talks about how it was something that she never really like expected or wanted necessarily, but that it was and it was really hard work. It was really hard work. And that she used things like the parking enforcement office to make way for student rights. So I think that's also kind of a lesson in making do with what you have. We were able to interview Jimenez's daughter, Dr. Stalina Villarreal, and she told us that Maria believed in a collective way of thinking, gravitating towards the title of organizer rather than leader, which you can see in her entire process, even an undergraduate. She says,
Well, first and foremost, I think she wanted to be remembered as an organizer because she did say that she was an activist, that it does take someone to, there were times when she was by herself holding up a sign, that it just takes at least one person to be an activist. But she really believed in the collective effort for, because she knew that social justice couldn't be done alone. And so I think that as an organizer, she was able to help people, but get them to act on their own and have agency so that she could be behind the scenes rather than up front. And I think she enjoyed that more than being a leader. She didn't like the word leader very much because it meant that you have followers, and she didn't like that kind of power dynamics. So I think she really wanted to be known as an organizer.
So she was a strategic thinker, and her reserved disposition, Jimenez's reserved disposition, made the moments in which she spoke out that much more powerful. In 1971, when Jimenez was still a college student, the Houston Young Women's Christian Association, so the YWCA, helped host one of the early Chicana conferences. During the first day, a group of Chicanas walked out protesting a variety of issues having to do with conference organization, the identity of conference organizers, and the topics covered. Maria was part of this walkout group, citing that it felt like no barrio or neighborhood women had been involved in the planning of the conference. So, this is what Maria says in her oral history about why she walked out. She also says, though, that she felt when at the time of the recording of her oral history, which was in 2016, she felt that she had been very young, and she could not quite remember why she had participated in the walkout, but this was something that she remembered, that she felt that no barrio women had been involved. Her daughter, Dr. Villarreal, recalls that her mother had had additional concerns regarding the unity of the Chicano movement and the way in which this conference might have been divisive among Chicanos and even among Chicanas themselves. So she was concerned, you know, is this conference really the right thing for us in this moment in the movement? And it's actually essential to note that that she was a self-proclaimed feminist even then, who fought arduously for immigrant women and mothers' rights, and in college helped establish a women's studies program as well as the Mexican American Center for Mexican American Studies as well. So these kind of two parts of her identity had to be balanced in a lot of what she did. And her hesitance to divide the Chicano movement was actually pretty common at the time, when faced with gender organizing as well. So I'll say that, I don't think that Jimenez's view on the subject necessarily was the same towards the end of her life as it was in 1971. But she does have some things to say about her outlook on gender. It's a pretty cool quote.
I don't fight in back of men, and I don't fight besides men. Many times I fight in front of men, and I don't care whether they like it or not.
So it's pretty clear that Jimenez had a deep understanding of how her gender identity and her racial identity made people perceive her. However, she was also really, really good at pushing past her feelings about a situation in order to create the change that she wanted to see. So I wonder if we can talk a little bit about what we can learn about coalition building from Jimenez's experience. What are some costs, some benefits that she experienced during her years as a young activist, do you think?
I think that one of the things that all of our señoras, but María Jiménez especially, helps me figure out is this concept of like activist leadership and what it means to be a leader, right? And why she would choose to not consider herself a leader in that way. And I think that this quote that you're bringing up about, fighting, not fighting besides men, not fighting in front of men, and not caring what men say is kind of. This is not a moment where she's saying all of these men are terrible, although she might have been saying that. But what I'm getting at is, I think that that's a critique to the forms of leadership that this kind of like activism requires or runs on, right? Her main reason for walking out is that the community had not been consulted, so there was no sense of coalition, collaboration. It was just the sense of being imposed yet another kind of way of thinking or yet another way of behaving or way of performing political action in a legible way, right? But I think that what she does and the kind of activism that she participates in, she's also involved in all of these other student organizations on campus, not just exclusively the Mexican American organizations, right? So she makes it very clear that it's not just about claiming this particular identity and like being a leader within that community. It's actually being a part of the community and listening to the community and doing things that the community itself wants to be doing.
Yeah, I have many, many responses. I think that this early Chicana conference, La Mujeres por la Raza, Conferencia, was so important. I remember reading about it in so many different scholarly articles and creative works. It was a really important moment because it made Chicana women legible as women of Mexican descent who had things to say that were separate from the Chicano movement. So I love the nuancing that Jimenez brings for exactly as Sophia is saying, because we've all gone to some kind of event where all the panels, all the speakers, all the activities are aligned with a very narrow ideology. And to go in feeling like how it was set up directly led to the almost immediate breakdown of the conference. It just provides so much clarity, I think, on such an important historical event. For Chicana history. And thinking about, communities and why Jimenez prefers organizer over leader, I feel like it's because people broadly really benefit from the kind of people who can lead but don't crave leadership. Like it's something that she can step up and do as like the president student body, but she didn't crave that and she didn't. It's because I think she didn't put her ego first and she didn't put other egos first either. That's what she's saying in that last quote, I think, is like men in the Chicano movement had a lot of big egos and She didn't really care about them, and she didn't care about her own ego either. It was more about what actions can be taken to improve the lived realities, the material realities of people's lives. And then I think my final thought, because that was a lot, is that she's really showing us that coalition building has to be intersectional, which is like a big word, but it just means to be attuned to the different ways that power accumulates around race, around class, around gender. And her story shows us that she had to sort of pivot in each different position that she was in order to see the intersecting sort of identities and complexities based on what needed to get done and who she was surrounded by.
Totally. Yeah, both of those are really great answers, and I think also tease out a little bit of my kind of preoccupations around it as well. And I say preoccupations pretty like intentionally, because when you are in a divisive moment, like I think Jimenez was in a divisive moment for much of her young organizing career. I think that we're in a divisive moment now. I think we can learn a lot from this moment of organizing, with civil rights organizing, specifically of like what you were saying, Sonia, being aware of kind of how power coalesces around race and gender. And you see it with Maria too. And I also wonder, like, what are the costs of it, right? Like, what are the costs of coalition building, of being that person who's willing to be a leader if necessary, who like doesn't want power but is willing to show your face if someone needs to take the fall, for example. Like, I think that she, when she talks about her life in her oral history, she talks a lot about, well, you know, this group of people did this, which I wasn't in agree with that much, but also in the end, we came together and changed some stuff, so that's okay. I think about, you know, that's one of the harder things about coalition building, is like you're never going to be 100% in agreement with the other people, but that it's still necessary to make change. And I admire Jimenez for having been able to thread that needle so well, of like staying with her integrity so strongly and also being able to compromise in a way that makes a productive coalition happen.
Yeah, I think one of the costs that, because you asked about cost and benefit of the work that she was doing, one of the costs is legitimately like offending people or like being a voice of dissent. And it's really hard to do that. I think we are in a divisive moment. Like we are also in a moment where it feels like you have to be very careful with what you say, where you have to sort of be attuned to all of the different ideologies, and to hold on to your value system and to feel like this is aligned with who I am. I have to make a decision with somebody who is not aligned with that. What am I willing to give and what do I refuse to budge on? Like these are questions we're asking ourselves now.
Yeah, and I think just in like continuing to think about like cost and what it means to be either a leader or like a dissenter, right? Like I feel like the cost is just going to be that you're going to be uncomfy for a little bit during this like meeting with your, you know, like activist group or whatever. That's the cost of like saying, like voicing the dissent, right? Like, hey, listen, we're not a united front here. Like we need to get our stuff together and figure out how to resolve all of the points of conflict that we have. Conflict is not inherently a bad thing, right? It just means that you're getting at the multiple different perspectives of everything that goes into a situation. And I feel like this is kind of the radical part of our señoras, especially again, Maria Jimenez. I think she's one of our most radical señoras, just in the sense that she's willing to, you know, to pay that cost of being uncomfortable, and she's also willing to put herself very tangibly at risk, right? Like deciding to take on these leadership roles that basically fell on her lap in a sense. Like people recognized her as a leader. She didn't show up and be like, "Make me your leader." It just kind of like happened. I think cost is one thing. I think risk is another thing that our señoras are always sort of weighing in terms of their participation. But yeah, but I think that is what radical work can look like or should look like.
Yes, I agree. And I think that Gabby, you very helpfully drew our attention to her lineage. And I think that having multiple women in your family who have feminist ideas without naming it feminism, right? Like they don't need to have that word to have the values that they have, but it does, like now we can see how it is feminist and how Jimenez saw that. And so I think like having the women in her lives who were not scared to offend men, who were not scared to say certain things like domestic work is real work. Don't romanticize cleaning, don't romanticize being a mother. That's hard stuff. Something like that is that builds your backbone up in many ways, I think, and it allows you to step onto a college campus probably for like it's just a really momentous thing. And for her to be able to enter those spaces and have that cost, like take that cost, take that risk, I think a lot of it does have to do with that history with her the women in her life.
Yeah, I think that experiencing that kind of community is something that not only uplifts you but shapes you, informs you. And I think also I definitely see the cost of speaking out. I think that a lot of our señoras experience that cost. I was also maybe thinking of the cost of staying silent, because in order to build coalitions, sometimes you have to stay silent about things that you don't agree with, right? And so that's what I was thinking about in the along the lines of like you see her being like, well, yes, I went and I was with the Young Democrats and I went and I was with the women's rights organization and all that stuff. It must have been hard. It must have been really hard to be like, I'm here. I'm not being considered in this moment, but at the same time, like these are more people for the cause. So I just think about that. Especially because she was so beloved. How is my question. And I think this helps actually segue to the next section, the next part of her life. So Jimenez actually said that at the time, so when she was finished, when she finished college and she was organizing in Houston as an activist, she felt like she could never date a Chicano. Because Chicanos would lose respect for you if they did not see you as a virgin or a mother. So that is what she mentioned in her oral history. That's the reality she experienced. And so she dated a Mexican man and moved to Mexico, Sinaloa, Mexico, in 1975. Taught as a professor at a university and organized. And she learned about her new environment little by little. She said that, you know, in the US, organizing was fraught for different reasons, but in Mexico, people were willing to put their literal lives on the line. So she's talked about, you know, being aware of like shootings happening specifically because of differences in political opinion. About around labor organizing, around like organizing at the university, all those things, that this scale of seriousness and intensity really made her understand the militant nature of organizing in where she was in Sinaloa, Mexico at the time. She said that she had to adapt to the way that the students would demand things of the faculty members as well. Faculty members who weren't necessarily openly on the student's side would get their cars messed up. Like she would have, she said she like would walk to her job or have her husband drop her off because she didn't want to have her car near the university. And this might seem extreme to some. I think that her takeaway was not necessarily, I mean, it was definitely like, oh, this is extreme, but it was more like she said that she learned how to organize in labor unions because of her time in Mexico. I think she learned what it was like to really be among militant people whose number one goal was getting better conditions. You may or may not agree with the methods, but I think that it really shows kind of what that experience, how that experience marked her. That when she came back to Houston in 1985 after separating from her husband, she went into labor organizing in a very serious and focused manner. She went on to teach at the University of Houston, but she also ran for local office for the Raza Unida Party. She said that in that instance, she was also kind of pushed into a position that she didn't ask for. Like, she was approached by colleagues and by people who she had met in undergrad organizing in Mayo, who were then at that point either strategists, like campaign strategists, or labor organizers, or politicians themselves. And they asked her, please, Maria, we need someone in this district to run for councilwoman. We need someone to represent the people. And she was a really strong candidate. Like, she won by a landslide. It was pretty wild. The way when you hear her talk about the situation, you're like, oh man, Maria, like, are you gonna win? But in reality, everyone loved her because even though she didn't want this leadership position, she was well known in the community because she was already fighting for their rights. She was already fighting for better conditions for them. And her career in general was one of an immigrant rights activist. She said she always went back to the migrant community because that was what she was most familiar with. As a migrant herself, she was most familiar with the Mexican migrant population. But she expanded to advocate for all migrants in the US, leading delegations to Washington, D.C., and really helping strategize about what the next move would be to help change policy in Texas specifically, and also in the nation to help immigrants. She's most remembered as this, but Dr. Villarreal, her daughter, assured us that her mother first and foremost wanted to be known as a Marxist organizer. This ideology is what drove her and allowed her to build these seemingly impossible coalitions. She was someone who really believed in collective action and communal good. Her goal was to organize the people so well that she would make herself obsolete. They would no longer need her in order to fight for their own rights. She remembers almost being left behind in Washington, D.C. after taking a group of migrants there to advocate for their rights. They did not need her to function, and she says this was a proud moment for her. I don't know if I've heard a more señora thing than that. But despite Jimenez's efforts to become obsolete, she is still remembered to this day as a strong organizer, a staunch believer in what is right. Her daughter said she was very loved and she loved other people, and that came from this idea of treating everyone with dignity and respect. Jimenez liked the phrase, ni de aquí ni de allá, because she felt that it summed up her border identity pretty well. Not Mexican enough, not American enough. But I think that she also felt that she was constantly switching from one setting to the next, organizing one group and then the other. So, for our last question, I want to ask y'all, do you think that ni de aquí ni de allá can be a strength rather than a drawback? And do you think that Jimenez's ability to switch around various groups is a señora trait?
Yeah, I think that ni de aquí ni de allá is definitely a strategy. I think it has strengths and I think it has drawbacks, right? But it depends on how you use the strategy, right? And the way that Jimenez was using it was a way to, learn a little bit from all of these groups that are doing different kinds of works, but very similar kind of work as well. So it's a cross-learning, collaborative kind of like movement between each and every one of these groups, instead of saying, I think, we're back to this problem of unity kind of thing. Like, in order to belong to a group, you have to be in agreement, united with the rest of like the group members and stuff like that. And again, I don't think conflict is necessarily a bad thing. And I think that her way of navigating conflict helps us see how, you just got to learn from other people. We can't just guide ourselves based on like identification with one particular kind of group. It's also about what you do for the group, how you participate in the group. Definitely a señora trait, definitely a border señora trait.
So she was able to move in these different circles because she garnered respect and she gave respect. And it goes back to that
that willingness to set aside ego and to focus on the goals and objectives that need to get done. And what I love about her time in Mexico and her admiration for the Zapatistas is that she saw what they were willing to do, and she was able to take some of those strategies and tactics and apply them in the ways that she could in a U.S. context, in a specifically Texas context, which, like, the work around migrant work is so Californian in many ways, which we can talk about later, but she's like, no, we need this in Texas, and here's how we're going to do it, which is, like, I think particularly special about her.
For sure, yeah. I think Jimenez was a very special señora, as all our señoras are special in different ways. But she, I think exactly what y'all were saying, where she took lessons that she learned in her life and applied them for the good of her community. And that's something that is very señora as well. So thank you all so much for joining us on this story of Maria Jimenez. If these activist señoras, Jimenez and Alicia Escalante, are interesting to you, then we have one more episode you can listen to. Stay tuned for our plática about both of these women.